Wrap up the discussion of deep inelastic scattering. Where we left off is we're computing this cross section at the parton level, which means we want to compute the scattering cross section between electrons and quarks, and then we're going to fold it in and see what it implies at the hadron level later on in the lecture. I think this is basically where we left off. We computed the differential cross section, and then what we did is we wanted to go and express this in terms of the quantities that we defined before, the kinematic variables we had before. So we were able to relate the Mandelstam variables at the parton level to the Mandelstam variables and other variables at the hadron level. So we had S hat was equal to X times S. We had T, which is equal to minus Q squared. This is also equal to minus X times Y times S. We also have U hat, which is minus S hat minus T hat, and that's equal to minus S times X, 1 minus Y. Now I can write the differential cross section in terms of these other variables. So I can write, for example, d sigma hat by dy is 2 pi alpha s q squared over q to the fourth. And then I have y squared plus 2, 1 minus y. Okay. All right, so now we are done with the parton level cross section. Remember, our total inclusive cross-section was the product of three terms in accordance with our discussion of factorization. We had the first part, which is the probability of finding a quark with a given momentum fraction or a given momentum inside the proton. That's the part that we still have left. We've computed the other two parts, the parton level scattering cross-section, and then also the third part, was not important since we're just interested in the occlusive cross section. Okay, so the last thing we need we need the probability to find a quark Q inside the proton with momentum fraction. X. Okay. And so this is something that we can't compute from first principles. It's something that must be measured experimentally. Or in principle, it could be predicted or using non-perturbative methods. But so we have this function, fq of x. So this is known as the parton distribution function. So if I write fq x dx, this is the probability of finding Q with momentum fraction between X and X plus dx. Okay, so this function at f of fq of x is a probability distribution function. It's often abbreviated just as PDF. Okay, so now I can write down the total inclusive cross-section. at the hadron level. So I have my parton level cross section. And then all I need to do is, question?
Just one quick thing. Are we working with everything massless or assumed like really small mass?
Yeah, everything is massless.
Okay.
Even the proton, we're assuming is massless. So, so here's our parton level cross section. I should multiply by this quantity here. This is the probability of finding a quark with a given momentum fraction. But then, of course, I have to sum over all of the possibilities. So that means I have to integrate over this momentum fraction, dx here. And then I also need to sum over all possible quarks I could have. I can't pick out one particular quark or another. So I should have also a sum over quarks like this. OK? So this is how you would compute it. And this is the idea of factorization. We have a non-perturbative part times a part that I can compute perturbatively. OK. Or I can write a differential cross-section. So I could write d sigma by dx. And so this would just be this sum, fq of x, and then the parton level cross-section. OK. Or I could write a doubly differential cross-section. So I can write d squared sigma by dx dy. And so now the PDF doesn't depend on y, of course. It just has to do with the initial state. Y is related to how much energy is transferred. And so that's a question of both initial and final states. And so I should have sum over q, fq of x, and then d sigma hat dy. OK? So here's our doubly differential cross section. So this is exactly what we computed before in our parton level calculation. But before we make that comparison, I want to discuss a little bit about the PDFs. Like, we have to do this sum over quarks. And so you might wonder, which quarks do we have to sum over? The proton has two up quarks and a down quark. Do we just sum over those? No, we don't want to just sum over those. We have to sum over all possible quarks. So let me just draw a cartoon to illustrate this. So what are the PDFs, and what quarks do we sum over? In particular, I'm scattering off of protons. These PDFs are specific for the proton. Every different hadron would have its own PDF. So you might say for the proton, this is up, up, and down. But this, of course, is a bit too simplistic. The proton is not really just made out of three quarks. The three quarks that I drew here are what are known as valence quarks. And I should think of the proton using the following sort of cartoon. So, okay, here's my proton. And it's propagating like this. So here's my proton out. And I could think of the valence quarks propagating like this. But then there are some turbulent sea of quarks and gluons that are going on in addition. It's a non-perturbative object, the proton. And so I have as many gluon interactions as I like. So I can exchange gluons between these quarks. And then a gluon, of course, can exchange a gluon with itself. And then a gluon can pop out of existence, out of the vacuum, a quark-antiquark pair, which will then annihilate like this. Or it doesn't have to be up quarks. It could be a strange quark like this. Like that. Okay? So my photon probe, when it collides with the proton, it doesn't necessarily need to interact with this line, this fermion line. It could interact with this one. Or it could interact with a U-bar. Or it could interact with an S or an S-bar. And so I have to include all possibilities, not just the valence quarks, but all possible quarks and antiquarks that I could have. So we want to sum over all quarks and antiquarks. So I can just sort of sketch what these functions look like. So I'm going to plot as a function of x the quantity of, this will be f q of x times x. So this will be a measure of the PDF for the different quark species. And here on the on the horizontal axis, it'll be a log scale. So we'll start at 10 to the minus 3. Then we'll have 10 to the minus 2, and then 0.1. So the up quark PDF, and these are all experimentally measured quantities. The up quark PDF looks something like this. The down quark PDF would look something like this. This is U, this is D, and then I have, this would be D bar, and then U bar is really similar looking. And then I also have other things down here. This would be S and S bar, and I have C and C bar, and then I even have B and B bar, like this. And then I also have gluons. So the gluon PDF is not relevant for this calculation, but it looks something like this. Okay, so at high momentum fraction, it's mostly valence quarks, U and D. At low momentum fraction, it's mostly gluons. The other point is that even heavier quarks exist inside the proton. You would say, well, a charm quark is even heavier than the proton is. It doesn't exist inside the proton, but it does. Okay. So, all right. So now I want to compare this calculation to the one we did before. So previously, we had the following, d squared sigma. Dx dy was equal to 2 pi alpha squared times s over q to the fourth. And then we had these functions, f1 of e, functions of x and q squared, times x, y squared, plus 2f2e. Of x and q squared times 1 minus y. And now I can compare it to this calculation. So here I have, this is the parton calculation. So I have d squared sigma. By dx dy. And so let's see, I have, right, this expression here. I think, am I missing a factor? X, Y. All right, let's just plug it in. So I have 2 pi alpha squared over q to the fourth. And then I have confused about this one factor. Hold on a second. Oh, no, sorry. It's OK. S. Am I missing? I think I'm missing a factor of S up here. Is that right? Yeah, well, let me write down what I have. So I have in my notes, we have a factor of S here. And then we have this sum over Q times the parton distribution function. And then I also have these terms Q squared like this. So I have the following. I have a sum over Q, Q squared. Then I have this parton distribution function, and then a factor of x like this. Times y squared. And then for the second term, proportional to 1 minus y, I have 2 times 1 minus y times this sum. The same expression here. Okay. And then I think I have also a factor of x over here as well. I think I'm getting confused by these factors of x. X. X squared. Yeah, I'm not sure. I have to go through it more carefully, or maybe you can. But anyway, I am unclear looking at my notes about the factors of x. We'll have to go through it more carefully. But the idea is that if we compare these two expressions, now we can read off these functions f1 and f2. So we have the following. F1 of x and q squared is equal to, let me write it like this. X times f1 of q squared is equal to f2 of x and q squared. And this is equal to the sum over q, qq squared, fq of x, like this. All right, and I can expand this out just to be a little more explicit. So I should be summing over quarks and then multiplying by the charges here. So this is like 2/3 squared fu of x plus minus 2/3 squared fu bar of x plus 1/3 minus 1/3 squared fd of x plus dot dot dot. Okay. So this is the idea. But then there's also a factor of x, sorry. So this should also have a factor of x. Okay. All right, apologize, I'm getting confused about these factors of x. In any case, what we have here by making this comparison is we have two important points to mention. So important point number one is that when we did the general calculation, our expression for F1 and F2 depended on two independent kinematic variables, which you could take to be x and q squared. And remember, for inelastic scattering, in general, we have this freedom where we have two independent variables. Here, when we do the parton level calculation, it doesn't depend on both x and q squared. It only depends on x. So that is fact number one. So the prediction from the parton model. Is that F1 and F2 only depend on x and not q squared. So what's the meaning of this fact? Remember, if we had elastic scattering, we only have one independent variable. And so the fact that these functions only depend on one kinematic variable is a secret hint that ultimately, we have elastic scattering at the parton level, that it's not an inelastic process, that the underlying process is elastic. Okay. All right, fact number two. These functions, which were independent before, F1 and F2, are now not independent. They both depend on the same linear combination of PDFs. And so we have this relation that x times F1e of x is equal to F2e of x. Okay, so if you measure these two things separately, you should be able to demonstrate this relation. This is known as the Callan gross relation. And this fact here, that it only depends on x and not q squared, is known as Bjorkian scaling. All right. So these two facts were really important in the 60s and 70s for demonstrating that hadrons were made out of quarks. Okay? So this tells you that scattering is scattering off of the constituents of the proton. And this is really telling you that we have quarks which have spin 1/2, that those partons have spin 1/2. For example, if quarks had spin 0, then we would get a similar calculation, but what we would find is that F1 e of x would be equal to 0. So we would only have F2. We'd have a different relationship here. All right? So it tells us that hadrons are made out of constituents, point-like constituents, and those constituents are spin 1/2. Okay. Now, the next step is that, well, we argued that these functions f1 and f2 only depend on x. They don't depend on q squared. That's only true because we were working at zeroth order in perturbation theory for the strong interaction. We did our calculation at zeroth order in alpha s. You can go beyond this and calculate the order alpha s corrections to the cross-section that we computed. And that will lead to violations of Bjorkian scaling. So I should say violations. So these are known as scaling violations. where now f1 and f2, which are only functions of x, now depend on x and q squared at order alpha s. And so by calculating these corrections and measuring how these functions depend on q squared is yet another prediction from QCD. And so that is even further evidence that our picture of the strong interaction is correct. OK. Any questions on this? Yeah.
How do they actually measure those distribution functions? Like, how do you know what kind of quarks you have, or like, yeah, what they're doing?
It's measured by this process. So you would measure it by measuring this scattering process. Basically, it's just you have an electron collider. You collide into a fixed target. You vary the energy. You vary the target. So you're probing different combinations of these PDFs. And that's how you do it. And you can use also different beams. So you could try like a neutrino beam, for example. Any other questions? All right. So we're going to change gears a little bit. And the next topic that we'll discuss over the next few days will be Higgs physics. So we're going to talk about Higgs decays and Higgs production, specifically at hadron colliders. All right. First, we're going to talk about the decays. And you know that the Higgs boson, which is left over due to the fact that we have to break the gauge symmetry of the Standard Model spontaneously, couples to all of the particles in the Standard Model that have mass. And of course, the larger the mass, the larger the coupling to the Higgs boson. So the most massive particles in the Standard Model are the W, the Z, and the top quark. So the Higgs has the largest couplings to W, Z, and top. But we know now that the mass of the Higgs boson is around 125 GeV. If it were kinematically allowed, the Higgs boson would like to decay only into these heavier states, since they have the larger couplings. But all of those two-body states are kinematically forbidden. So now, that's actually good. It's a good thing. Because that means that we're able to measure the Higgs couplings to not only these dominant states, but we can also measure the Higgs couplings to subleading, through subleading couplings to other states as well. All right. So first, I want to talk about the tree level decays. So we have Higgs decaying into fermions. So for example, let's write down an interaction where I have the Higgs coupling to psi bar psi. And the coupling of the Higgs boson is just proportional to the mass of that particular fermion divided by the VeV. And it's straightforward to compute the matrix element for this decay. Here would be the Feynman diagram for momentum q, and then it goes into a fermion and an antifermion. And so the matrix element would just be minus I m psi over v u of p, v of p prime. Where here, p and p prime are the momenta of the fermion and antifermion. All right, so it's also straightforward to square the matrix element, sum over spins. You get to 2 m psi squared over v squared times 4 p dotted into p prime, which is equal to 2 m psi squared mh squared over v squared. Okay. Okay, so now we can ask, how large are these branching ratios and decay widths for standard model fermions? So let's just go through them. We can just worry about the heavier ones. So we shouldn't include TT bar, of course, because that's forbidden. But then we should also include other ones as well. So we have, so first let me write down the general formula for the decay rates. So that should be 1 over 16 pi mh times the sum of the squared matrix element. So first, we'll write down for tau tau bar. So I have m tau squared mh over 8 pi v squared. OK, so this is, when I plug in numbers, 0.26 MeV, which turns out to be around 6.3% of the total branching rate. Now I also have decays into quarks. The only one, the heaviest one that's allowed is bottom quarks. And so this is MB squared MH over 8 pi V squared. It's exactly the same calculation as above, but of course I just need to make one small modification. I need to multiply by the number of colors. So I should just multiply by 3 here. And so this turns out to be 4.3 MeV, or around 58% of the total rate. And then I also have decays into charm quarks. This would be the same as the bottom quark, just with MC. And this turns out to be 0.4 MeV, or around 2.9%. OK. Now you can go home and compute these things, plug in the masses of the bottom quark, the masses of the charm quark, the mass of the Higgs. You get the wrong answer. The reason is that when you plug in the mass of the bottom and the mass of the charm, those are, well, I should say, the masses change as a function of renormalization scale. So the masses that I should plug in to this rate are not at the same scale at which the masses themselves are measured. So let me just put an asterisk here. So I should say the renormalization group of MC and MB, and this is due to the strong interaction from the scale at which these masses are measured, which is just the mass scales themselves, to MH reduces MC and MB by factors of 2 and 4. No, it's the other way around. 4 and 2, respectively. OK. So the RG effects are important to getting it correct.
what's the scale at which the masses are measured?
Right. So there's kind of two masses to worry about. One is the pole mass, and so you can think of that as the physical mass of the quark, like the mass of the charm quark, let's say, the pole mass. But the quantity entering into the Higgs decay is not really the pole mass, it's the parameter in the Lagrangian. It's really just this factor of mc over v, which multiplies this particular coupling. And so you need to evolve that coupling from the pole mass, so for the case of the bottom quark, that's around 4 GeV, up to the mass scale of the Higgs, around 125 GeV.
So it's the mass that appears. We're saying that this mass, the mass that appears here, is the renormalized mass. That's good.
So it would be the renormalized mass parameter entering into the Lagrangian. All right. Okay. So these are the two-body decays at tree level to fermions. We also have the following tree level decays. So we have the Higgs decaying into W plus, W minus, and Z, Z. And of course, these are forbidden kinematically, unless one or both gauge bosons are off shell. So I should think about this decay in the following way. So I have decays into two Zs, one or maybe both are off shell, and then the Zs can decay into fermion pairs. And of course, they don't have to decay into the same one. So experimentally, the channel in which the Higgs decays into two Zs, one off shell, and then each Z decays into a pair of leptons, charged leptons, this is very clean to measure and allows you to measure the mass of the Higgs, because it's easy to reconstruct all of the momenta of the four leptons in the experiment. So this is known as the golden mode. So where psi and psi prime are the electron and the muon, which are the cleanest objects that can be seen in the collider environment. So the idea is that you have a Higgs decaying into ZZ star, and then these decay into lepton pairs. So you write it like this. Decays into four leptons. Here, leptons really just means electron and muon. Tau, to a collider experimentalist, is not a lepton. Okay. Or it is, but it's just challenging, more challenging to see. Now, you can also do the same thing for the W, but if it's decaying into charged leptons, it's also decaying into neutrinos, so it's a lot harder to reconstruct the mass of the Higgs if you have missing energy in the collider. If you calculate the decay rates, which we're not going to do, decay into ZZ star is around 0.11 MeV, which is 2.6%. And the decay into WW is 0.88 MeV, and this is 22%. Yeah.
What makes this channel, the golden mode channel, cleaner than, say, a tree level decay into fermions?
Right. So, well, Which one do you want to think about? So let's look at the bottom quark. Obviously, that one would be nice since it has the largest branching fraction. But unfortunately, QCD can also produce lots of BB bar pairs. So it's really a question of backgrounds that's killing you.
Sorry.
Yeah?
Those expressions for H to BB bar, H to CC bar depend on the renormalization scale, or do they not? The renormalization scheme?
These parameters are physical, but then you have to compute it using perturbation theory.
Yeah.
And so at a fixed order in perturbation theory, it will depend on the scale.
Okay. On the scheme.
Yeah, it should also depend on the scheme, since that also can factor in as well. Okay, so those are the tree level decays. Now we're going to talk about the loop level decays. So we have Higgs to gluons and Higgs to two photons. So this one turns out to be numerically 0.35 MeV, which is 8.6%. And this one is 6 × 10⁻³ MeV, which is 0.15%. So you might wonder, of course, the photon is massless, the gluon is massless. How can the Higgs decay into particles that are massless? And the answer is here. It's not coupling directly, but it's coupling at one loop. So these two channels are arguably the most important channels for Higgs physics. This one, you probably know, was the most important channel for discovering the Higgs. But actually, this one, as we'll show, is the most important channel for actually making the Higgs. When you have protons colliding together, they have a lot of gluons. And so the inverse process, where you have two gluons fusing together to make a Higgs, is the most important, or at least the dominant channel, for production in a hadron collider. OK. So this one is it's rare, but experimentally clean. So this is another golden mode. And this one is very important for production. Where you have two gluons going invert through kind of an inverse decay to make a Higgs. So what we're going to do is we're going to compute this one. So let's compute this. There's two Feynman diagrams we have to worry about. So I'll divide them up as M1 and M2. So here's the Higgs. And I want to couple to two gluons. So I need a loop diagram. And I need to introduce a particle in the loop that couples to gluons and also has a large coupling to the Higgs boson. So that will be, of course, the top quark. So here's a top quark loop. So here's the top. And then we'll couple to two gluons here. And so here will be my gluon fields. And they'll have momentum p and p prime. The Higgs will have momentum q. And I also have a loop momentum. So we'll have momentum k here. This will be k plus q. And this will be k plus p prime. And the next diagram, M2, is exactly the same, just with the gluon lines crossed. So this is still p prime, and but the loop momenta are just slightly different. I'll have like a k, and then this will be k plus q, and this will be k plus p. Okay. So you can see one other point here. Even though the Higgs is not decaying into top quarks directly, you might worry that we can't actually probe the top Higgs coupling, but through Higgs to glue-glue, we can indirectly probe the Higgs top coupling. Okay, so we're going to go through this exercise and compute this decay rate. And we're going to compute this one loop diagram. All right, so the first one, I have an integral over k. I'll have a minus 1 for a fermion loop. Then I have a trace of I k slash plus mt over k squared minus mt squared. I have the strong coupling. Then I have I k slash plus p prime slash plus mt over k plus p prime squared minus mt squared. Then I have I gs ta gamma mu. Then I have I k slash plus q slash plus mt over k plus q squared minus mt squared, and then I have the Yukawa interaction I mt over v, and then I have the polarization vectors for the external gluons. Okay, so you may have noticed we're doing this loop integral in d dimensions, not in four dimensions. This integral is going to turn out to be finite. So why am I working in d dimensions? Turns out that there's actually an important subtlety here, which is that once we do this integral, you'll see we'll get something that's the product of two terms. One will be a divergent term, and the other term will be 0 in the limit that d goes to 4. So it's important to regularize that divergence in order to get the right answer. If you just try to do the integral in four dimensions, you'll get the wrong answer. Okay.
What are TA and TB?
Yeah, TA and TB are supposed to be the SU3 generators. Okay. So I can simplify this expression a bit. We have minus gs squared. We have the trace over. So this trace, remember, doesn't just go over the spinner indices, the Dirac indices, but it also takes the trace of the color structure as well. So I'll have the trace of TA, TB, and then I'll have MT over V. I'll have the polarization vectors. And then I'll have this integral. Trace of K slash plus MT, gamma nu, K slash plus P slash plus MT, gamma mu, and then K slash plus Q slash plus MT. And all of this is over this denominator, K squared minus MT squared, K plus P prime squared minus MT squared, and then K plus Q squared minus MT squared. Okay. So we want to do this loop integral. And so we're basically just going to use the standard box of tricks to evaluate this loop integral. The first step is to use Feynman parameters to combine the denominators together. All right, so we have this matrix element is G squared, trace of TA, TB. And then I have MT over V, epsilon mu, epsilon nu. And then the standard trick for using Feynman parameters is now I have to integrate over the Feynman parameters dx, dy, dz. And I have a factor of 2 delta of 1 minus x minus y minus z. And this allows me to combine the denominators in the following way. So now I have k squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y plus k plus q squared minus mt squared z. And then I have cubed here. OK, and then the numerator is still the same. OK, so now I want to manipulate this factor in brackets in the denominator. So then I can do a shift in the integration. So let's write out the term in brackets. So I have k squared minus mt squared x plus k plus p prime squared minus mt squared y. And then I have k plus q squared minus mt squared z. And once I expand everything out, I can write it as follows. I can write it in the form of some other momentum L squared minus M squared, where now L is equal to K plus Y times P prime plus Q times Z, like this. And M squared is MT squared minus XZ MH squared, like so. So I'm skipping a bunch of algebraic steps, which are not too complicated, but this is what you get. Yeah, good question. So So when I expand out this term up here, I'll have different products like I'll have some different cross terms. For example, P prime dotted into Q, for example. So if I evaluate this, I have P prime dotted into P prime plus P. And P prime squared is equal to 0 because it's a gluon. But I'll still have P dotted into P prime. And I can write this as 1 half P plus P prime squared, since the terms that are P squared and P prime squared are still 0. And this is 1 half Q squared. And so this is 1 half MH squared. So it comes from manipulations like this. OK. All right, so now that I've manipulated the denominator, what I want to do is shift the integration to be not over k, but over l. So I need to express the numerator, this trace, in terms of l instead of k. So we'll shift k is equal to l minus y p prime minus z q in the numerator. So we have the trace of this stuff. And it's straightforward to make this substitution, plug it into the trace, and expand it out in the usual way. And I'll just write down what the answer is. You get 16 mt squared l mu l nu minus 4 l squared mt e to mu nu plus 4 mt cubed e to mu nu minus 2 mt mh squared 1 minus 2xz e to mu nu plus 4 1 minus 4xz p1 nu p2 mu times mt. These are not all of the terms that you would find, but I've thrown away some of the terms. What terms have I thrown away? So I've neglected terms proportional to p. Oops, sorry, this should be p and p prime. P mu or p prime nu. I can neglect terms like this because where p mu contracts with its corresponding polarization vector, you just get 0. I've also neglected terms that are odd in L, since those will vanish due to antisymmetry of the integral. So keeping only these leftover terms that are important, this is what I have. Then I have to make one last substitution, which is that in d dimensions, you can make the following replacement. I can write L mu L nu as 1 over D L squared A to mu nu. This just comes from symmetry under the integral. And you can check this, because if you just contract the two sides with A to mu nu, this we'll go to 8 mu nu, and then I argue that this should be 1 over d, 8 mu nu times L squared, and this is just 1 over d times d L squared. Okay, so 8 mu nu will just give us d. All right. Oh, out of time.
But isn't that just showing that the trace is the same?
Yeah, that's right. So the trace, the terms that are, so the trace is the same. Any term that's not proportional to the trace will vanish under the integral. That's the claim. Okay, so so we have these manipulations. Let me put all the pieces together first, and then that will be the last formula that I'll write down. Okay, so this will be, so here's what we have so far. We have minus g squared, the trace of TA, TB, mt squared over v, epsilon mu, epsilon nu. We have this integral in d dimensions, now over L because we've shifted it. Then we still have this Feynman parameter integral. We have a denominator, 1 over L squared minus M squared cubed times the following factor. We have 16 over D minus 4 times L squared 8 mu nu plus 2 MT squared minus MH squared 1 minus 2XZ. Times 8 mu nu plus 4, 1 minus 4 xz p nu p prime mu. Okay, so after all of these various steps, this is the expression that we get. On Monday, we're going to pick up with this and evaluate these momentum integrals. But you can see here this claim that I made before that we have to think carefully about the number of dimensions that we're working in. This term here, L squared over L squared cubed, when we integrate in four dimensions, will give us something that's divergent. But it multiplies something that vanishes as d goes to 4. And so the product of the divergence here times something that vanishes will give us something finite. And that finite term will be important to giving us the right answer. Otherwise, we'll get a result that turns out not to be gauge invariant. Okay, so that's all for today. We'll pick up on Monday.